Now, the legislature, by requiring majority approval, it made it clear it did not expect everybody to be on board. The legislature could have set a number higher than a majority. It could have required all the senior right holders to have signed on to a petition, but that's not what it did. And in this GMP, though, I think it's important to note that it wasn't approved just by a simple majority. It was approved by a majority of senior right holders. So the only seniors to have challenged the GMP in all of Diamond Valley are the Baileys, and they are a respondent here. Sadler Ranch and the Renners are not senior groundwater users of rights that are subject to the GMP. So I just want to make that clear that the only seniors to challenge it are one of the respondents here. So importantly also, the GMP honors priorities. It has this priority factor that was a major point of debate during the GMP development process, and it was what a majority could agree to.
Let me pause you there, though. First of all, the GMP never equalizes, not even in 35 years, the over-pumping issue. You're still not underwater, but over the amount that basin can sustain, even 35 years from now. So could you comment on that and how that fits in this statutory scheme and your discussion of the legislature's object here?
Sure. The GMP does bring the basin into balance within 35 years. The benchmark reduction table that I think Your Honor was referring to is not accounting for recharge into the aquifer, so it doesn't, when you look at just consumptive use, and that there's actually another table that's located, and I think it's at Joint Appendix Volume 4, pages 838 to 839. It'll show you that when you take into account consumptive use only, then and recharge into the aquifer, then it will bring the basin within 30,000 acre feet within the time frame set forth in the GMP.
But that point is reached in 35 years? So there are 35 years in which it's in imbalance.
That is correct. That there are benchmark reductions. They might be more aggressive, but under the table that is in the appendix and in the GMP, it would take 35 years. Now, the district court said that that complies with the statute, and if you look at the statutory language, it makes very clear that you don't have to bring a basin into balance right away. And of course, that makes sense, because if you were going to, that would be curtailment, 100% curtailment immediately, which is what the legislature was trying to avoid.
So could it be 100 years?
I think, Your Honor, that brings into focus the next point that I wanted to make, is that there are very, the legislature set very sturdy guardrails by which the state engineer should approve a GMP, and has to take into account a number of factors. And the criteria are listed, but the hydrology, the physical characteristics of the basin. So your question with regard to 100 years, it would be on a case-by-case basis, based on the hydrology, the geology, the well, the withdrawals, an individual basin. What is appropriate for that basin?
Yeah, it was striking reading the record and the Herald report from 1960. We're exactly where it was viewed that we would be and that we were then, and yet we're taking another 35 years forward into the future. And it's difficult, and there's no money there for the senior water rights holders. The state has not committed any money, so the Lewis case seems distinguishable on its face to me.
Your Honor mentioned a number of things. I think the very first thing that you mentioned with regard to, I would characterize it as how we got to this situation. I think the legislature was very clear that it wasn't interested in looking backwards. It wanted to look forward. And so it wasn't, you know, criticizing the state engineer for how things have been managed in the past. It was saying, this is the situation. How are we going to solve it? And I think it's a very forward-looking piece. With regard to money for the seniors, I want to be very clear that the legislature has modified the prior appropriation doctrine under certain circumstances. I think that the most recent change, the 2019 amendment to NRS 534.110 regarding domestic well holders, is a really good example of this, because what that says is that even if the state engineer curtails priority in a basin such that a senior, for example, irrigator would get zero, a junior domestic well owner could still pump. And that is a perfect example of where the legislature, as a policy matter, prioritized that we don't want domestic well owners to suffer, and so we're going to make sure they get water even when something's curtailed.
That's more explicit, though, than they've been in this statute.
I absolutely agree with you on that, but I think the key thing to keep in mind is the legislature recognized that individual basins have very specific, you know, characteristics, be they hydrology, geology, social, economic, where the wells are located, all sorts of different things. And the legislature really put this in the hands of local people. I think that's very clear. That's where the majority language comes into play. It's basically said, figure it out. And so I think where the language specifically says that the state engineer does not have to conform to priorities, while it's not as specific as the domestic well statute, I think it is certainly in line with where elsewhere the legislature has departed from prior appropriation in limited circumstances.
Is it your contention that the statute deserves a plain meaning reading and that supports your position? Or are you saying it's ambiguous and we need to resort to legislative history?
I think the plain meaning of the statute is clear when it says unless a GMP has been approved pursuant to the statute, that the state engineer does not have to conform to priorities. I think that is clear that it allows for a GMP just as we see here.
I'm taking up a lot of your time, but could you walk me through the plain language analysis that you believe is so clear?
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at the language, it says, if a basin has been designated as a critical management area for at least 10 consecutive years, the state engineer shall order that withdrawals, including without limitation, withdrawals from domestic wells, be restricted in that basin to conform to priority rights, comma, unless. And then after unless, it says, unless a groundwater management plan has been approved for the basin pursuant to NRS 534.037. Now, if the legislature just wanted to have the state engineer curtail by priority, it didn't need to do anything because that was already the law. If it wanted to just get the state engineer acting more quickly, it could have just created this critical management area designation and not provided for the GMP process. It would have just stopped there, right? Said, state engineer, get it done. Designate them as critical management areas and then 10 years later, you have to start curtailing. Get them time to get their affairs in order. But that's not what it did. It's this whole new process of a GMP that it didn't have to provide for and that didn't exist in the law before. And so...
But aren't there things that a GMP can do other than overturn priorities? In other words, the fact that it allowed for a groundwater management plan, why does that necessarily imply that that's an intent to allow variation from priorities?
Well, I think a number of things would address that. First, that it's a principle of statutory construction that when the statute says, creates criteria, has language that specifies how things should be done, that it's at the exclusion of other things. So I think that's sort of the basic premise. I think there's also a practical piece of this too, that as a practical matter, the seniors consume all 30,000 acre feet. If they don't change their behavior, the only way that you can get a basin into balance is by 100% curtailment. So that's the status quo. The legislature clearly wanted to do something different than that. And so it doesn't matter if the juniors conserve 10%, 20%, 80, 90%, even if they're conserving 99.9%, which is essentially curtailment by another name, you're still exceeding the perennial yield. So again, it goes back to, why did the legislature create this new process that didn't exist in the law?
Well, couldn't it be, for instance, trying to encourage community-based solutions? And in doing that, trying to get the senior holders to work with the junior holders. And why isn't it possible for that to happen? Senior holders and the junior holders get together and say, here's a groundwater management plan that doesn't affect prior appropriations, it may affect prior appropriations, but we all agree to this.
Well, I think a key response to that is that one of the criteria that the legislature put in the legislation is that the plan has to take the steps necessary to remove the CMA designation. If you're relying exclusively on voluntary reductions by seniors, you can't get there because they don't have to voluntarily do anything. So if you present to the state engineer a GMP that says, well, we hope to work together with the seniors to get them to reduce their pumping, you're not going to be able to say, or the state engineer won't be able to say, I can tell that this is going to take the necessary steps to reducing.
But for the overall health of the basin, why can't they do that?
They certainly can do that.
They would be interested, I'm sure, in making sure the basin was healthy, the senior holders.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think that's making assumptions as to how people might act, but I can tell you that my clients worked for years and years and years to try to put together a plan that worked for everyone. They explored all sorts of ideas. They, retain consultants and experts in economics to help them figure out what is a potential solution here. This is what a majority came up with. And I emphasize that that's all that the legislature required. It just said majority. And as an example of what you just raised, it could have said, and we need to include all the seniors too. And that's not what they said. So that's why I continue to go back to the notion that they made this exception to the prior appropriation doctrine, and it's not out of line with other things that the legislature has done with regard to the prior appropriation doctrine.
Ms. Leonard, I have two questions I wanted to raise with you, and I know time is running. The first has to do with NRS 534.037. By the way, this statutory scheme is another example my perspective of the state engineer being put in an extremely awkward position to help resolve and mitigate challenges that exist between senior and junior right holders. Of concern to me was subsection G. When applying the factors on the establishment of the GMP, it states any other factor deemed relevant by the state engineer, were there other factors that were reflected in the record that the state engineer used in approving this? And B, if so, what would be the source of those? Would they be adopted regulations? Where did it come from?
So, Your Honor, to be candid, I don't recall specifically in the order whether the state engineer addressed other I can give you an example of where the state engineer thought it was important that this GMP does recognize priorities. Mm-hmm. The state engineer also, thought it was important to that this was what the community came together and was able to come up with, and that they had worked very hard on it and taken into consideration a lot of things. To get to that result, I think it's very clear the state engineer relied on the record in front of him, either written submissions of the petition for the GMP, public comments, the hearing that he held. I think it's clear that he only relied on the record in front of him.
Then the second question I had, there's been some arguments made that this scheme that was adopted by the legislature for the GMP process may be unconstitutional as a taking. Is that an issue that we need to get into in a petition for judicial review? It seems to me that the question in a petition for judicial review is to interpret and understand the statute under which the program was adopted. If someone has a problem with it from a taking standpoint, that should be a separate action.
And so we
are all lathered up in a lot of the paperwork that's been filed with this court and with the district court over constitutional rights, but I'm not sure that this is the appropriate venue to litigate or decide that question. So if Bailey, for example, has a legitimate basis for a taking claim, assuming that we approved the state engineer's action here, it would seem like that taking claim is something that would be the subject of a different matter another day.
I 100% agree with you that this is not the appropriate place to be considering a taking claim for a couple of reasons. One is it is a petition for judicial review, mm-hmm. In which there's not a claim, so to speak, for mm-hmm. a taking. And the second is because really they didn't press it below. The respondents did not press a taking below. They mentioned it in their PJR, but they did not ever really advance that argument in front of the district court. But I do not think it's within the realm of what this court needs to decide. I think the district court said substantial evidence supported this decision and the state engineer complied with the statutory requirements. That should be enough to affirm.
I said I had two questions, but I have a third.
Okay.
And perhaps you can confer with the state engineer's counsel unless you know. Have there been any other GMPs adopted for other basins throughout the state, or is this the only one?
This is the only one.
First
and only, and it's the first basin to be designated as a critical management area.
But there are, as we know from lots of sources, many other basins in which the perennial yield is exceeded by the amount of rights authorized.
That is correct, that the court's decision is going to have impacts far beyond Diamond Valley.
And I think there are curtailments in some other basins even that are running their course, is that right?
I can't tell you what the current state of curtailment orders are, but I can tell you that obviously this has been a very light year on precipitation and snowpack, and it's going to have a big effect on the resource and the associated water users in the state.
All right, you're at 6:26. I'll add 3 minutes to your rebuttal time, and we'll add 3 minutes to respondents' time. Are you ready to proceed? Okay. Are you taking all the time, Mr. Mixon?
I will be taking, we've agreed, Mr. Regan and I have agreed to split our time.
Okay.
So I had intended to take 15, and I'll stick with that despite the extra 3, which I appreciate.
Okay.
And we've also agreed to divide the issues. I will be addressing prior appropriation and time allows beneficial use doctrine. And Mr. Rigdon will address impairment of senior vested water rights and other statutory violations.
Okay.
So may it please the court. There's no dispute that the Diamond Valley groundwater aquifer is in dire shape. There's also no dispute that the primary cause of this condition is the state engineer's failure for at least a half a century to regulate overpumping of groundwater in the basin. The groundwater management plan for Diamond Valley attempts to create an entirely new water system applicable only in Diamond Valley that reallocates water from senior water rights to junior water rights. And none of the parties, including the appellants, dispute that the GMP violates the prior appropriation doctrine. So the core of this case is whether the state engineer is permitted to approve a groundwater management plan that violates Nevada's fundamental prior appropriation doctrine, and fundamental beneficial use doctrine, simply because a majority of water users in the basin voted to do so.
Well, Council, under Ms. Leonard's characterization of the statute and her view of the plain meaning of the statute, it does seem to be all-inclusive. The language says, shall order that withdrawals. It doesn't say what types. It says withdrawals. Then it says, including without limitation, domestic wells. That it would be an obvious inclusion because of the handling of domestic wells different than water rights. Be restricted in that the basin to conform to priority rights. That seems to be all withdrawals. So what about that interpretation of the statute is wrong?
Well, the notion of vested rights, of course, Mr. Rigdon's going to address, and the impairment by the GMP. But with respect to the interpretation...
Well, we got to start with the interpretation of the statute.
With respect to the interpretation of 534.110, I think what Ms. Leonard's discussion ignores is subsection 6. And you have to read the statute as a whole. And you have to read those two subsections together. Subsection 6 says, if the state engineer designates a groundwater basin and the conditions allow, he may curtail water rights by priority. That existed before AB 419 in 2011. In 2011, AB 419 adds, to subsection 6, it adds, except as otherwise provided in subsection 7, it then adds subsection 7. Subsection 7 says, if the state engineer, or if the basin is designated as a critical management area, the state engineer shall curtail water rights by priority if it's been designated for 10 years, unless he approves a GMP. The shall in subsection 7 is what's important. It creates mandatory curtailment.
But
why
shouldn't we evaluate that language on a ratable reduction, which is kind of what the GMP did here, as opposed to a priority reduction? If you reserve all of the perennial yield for the seniors, there's no reduction to the seniors whatsoever. The language you're referencing seems to me to imply or even state that there's going to be a ratable reduction of priorities throughout the basin.
Well, I don't read the language as implying permission to reduce senior rights on the backs of providing water for
children. Well, no, I understand you don't read it that way, but I'm asking, why isn't it reasonable to read it as a reduction on a ratable basis, on an aliquot basis?
Because that doesn't comport with the prior appropriation doctrine. The prior appropriation doctrine in Nevada says that senior rights are entitled to the full use of their water in times of shortage.
Well, I think the subsections you referenced are contemplating that there could be a reduction based on priorities, and I'm wondering why that couldn't be ratable.
I don't see that in the language. It says the state engineer shall curtail by priority unless there's a GMP in subsection 7.
So one of the things you were going to talk about, I think, had to do with in establishing the GMP, whether there was an appropriate evaluation of a beneficial use. Was that one of the topics you were going to address?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't we get to that? Because I think that's a significant issue here as well.
Before you move on, I have a question about subparagraph 6 that you just alluded to. It speaks to in the permissive may curtail by priority. What else is contemplated that the state engineer could do? Default in his duty to get the basin in balance? I mean, what do you think, if you didn't have paragraph 7, would be an option to curtailment under paragraph 6?
An option in the alternative to curtailment?
Yes.
Well, I think that the state engineer, well, under the Nevada water law statutes, there are many ways to enforce the prior appropriation doctrine other than strict curtailment by priority. For example, and this gets to the beneficial use question, water rights permits issued by the state engineer are essentially provisional. And in order to prove up your permit so that you can get a final certificate, you have to put your water right to use under the provisional permit. And you're only given a certificate for the amount of water that you are capable and do put to beneficial use. So a provisional permit can result in a certificate with less water. And by if the state engineer would enforce the cancellation of unused water permits or unused portions of water permits, he could reduce the amount of water rights and the demand on the aquifer. That is one example of a non-curtailment remedy.
And your argument here is this GMP actually does the opposite.
Correct. So under the problem with the beneficial use violations of the GMP is that, for example, these unused permits or unused portions of permits are given full allocations and shares under the groundwater management plan, even though the holder of that permit has not proven its actual ability to put the water to beneficial use.
Mr. Mixon, was there a calculation made of the water rights that were incorporated in the GMP for which appropriate consideration of the proof of beneficial use had not been accomplished? I'm trying to quantify this issue and the relationship between the plan that was adopted versus the plan that might have been adopted had, as part of the considerations under the factors here, incorporated that calculus.
I understand your question, and the answer is no. It was not quantified. I think that is one of the fundamental deficiencies in the state engineer's factual determination.
And did you request that when the state engineer was developing the plan?
I did not personally. I hadn't been engaged with my clients, but
your clients.
No, they did raise it as an issue in their written comments, but they're laypersons, and so their comments didn't specifically demand or request that the state engineer actually quantify the amount of permits that have not yet been put to beneficial.
So this gets to my question about the proof of beneficial issue. I'm intrigued by the argument, and I can understand the senior's concern, just as you've articulated to Justice Pickering. But if it wasn't quantified, if it wasn't laid out in the record, if it wasn't an alternative calculus for the state engineer to consider, was it waived?
Was it waived by
as
a challenger?
Yes, right.
I don't think it would have been waived because it was not a formal legal proceeding. It was a public hearing to take public comments, not testimony under oath.
So did you raise a calculus of the type we're talking about to the district court?
I don't think it was raised as a specific issue that the state engineer should have calculated, although
because it seemed like
I didn't, because I honestly just can't remember.
There's a lot of paperwork here, so I appreciate the challenges in remembering this. But I didn't see it really float up as an intriguing issue until it got to us.
If I could just run through, I hate to do numbers in front of you, but
sure, no.
The state engineer didn't.
Some people have accused me of being a bean counter. Let's throw that in.
On paper, there are approximately 126,000 acre feet. Mm-hmm. Of irrigation permits granted by the state engineer.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, which is sort of the benchmark number that's been used by the GMP and by the state engineer, there was approximately 76,000 acre feet pumped from the basin for irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
That the difference between the 126,000 acre feet on paper permits and the 76,000 acre feet that was pumped in 2016 is 50,000 acre feet
mm-hmm.
of water rights on paper that were not used. Some portion of that 50,000, presumably it's a significant portion, but it was not calculated below, is water that has not been put to beneficial use, may never be put to beneficial use because it's incapable mm-hmm. of being put to beneficial use. So I
get that argument, Mr. Okay. Mixon. I was intrigued by it. But I'm trying to understand whether it's appropriate for us to deal with that. The calculus you've just gone through, I don't think is something that was developed, perhaps understandably with the process in front of the state engineer, but in front of the district court either. Right?
Those numbers were certainly brought to the district court's attention.
Yeah.
The calculus of the unused permits and the portions of the unused permits is something that, at least from my perspective and on behalf of my clients, is the state engineer's sole obligation. The Baileys are not capable of gathering the information to make that happen.
So under which of the factors in 534.037 do you think the state engineer should take into consideration? I could see some that would apply, but is there one in particular that you, or maybe more than one?
Well, obviously, G, other applies.
And we've been down that catch-all.
And then, you know, A, the hydrology of the basin, arguably, but let me address the factors in 534.037, subsection 2.
Sure.
The appellant's argument is, the state engineer, having been provided a groundwater management plan approved by a majority of the water users in the basin, all he's required to do is consider the factors under subsection 2 of that statute. And if he determines that the groundwater management plan could result in removal of the CMA designation, he can approve it. They say that's the end of the story. But I want to draw your attention to these factors. These are not legal. These are scientific and hydrologic factors that are obviously within the purview of the state engineer. But none of these references or sets forth a legal standard. Hydrology of the basin, physical characteristics of the basin, geographic spacing of the wells, water quality, whether the plan already exists, none of these are legal. So when the appellants say, if the state engineer considers these, that's the end of the story. That is fundamentally what the district court rejected. And he said, no, you have to also look at whether the groundwater management plan complies with the rest of the water law, not just the technical factors under subsection 2 of 534.037. And so, to me, that their argument therefore falls apart, because the groundwater management plan, it's conceded, does violate the prior appropriation doctrine, and of course I argue it violates the beneficial use doctrine.
Do you acknowledge that the legislature could, if it wanted, allow groundwater management plans that don't strictly follow priorities?
I fully agree that had the legislature wanted to exempt groundwater management plans from existing law, they could do so with express language in the statute.
Okay.
But we are talking about fundamental prior appropriation doctrine for Nevada, and if the legislature is going to waive that doctrine for a groundwater management plan, it must do so expressly with express terms of the statute, which it did not do here.
If I may, why isn't unless express?
Unless is an express exception to the mandatory curtailment of subsection 7 of 534.110. It's not an exception to the entire prior appropriation doctrine. Under 534.110 subsection 6, there is still permissive curtailment at the discretion of the state engineer. So that unless a GMP is approved, is only as an exception to 534.110 subsection 7 A and B, which are critical management area designations.
So what's the point of allowing the groundwater management plan? What kinds of things can a groundwater management plan do if it doesn't have the opportunity to adjust, say, the prior appropriation?
So the goal, as stated in the statute, 534.037, is to allow for the state engineer to remove a critical management area designation. That's the statutory goal.
Right.
And presumably, that means reducing pumping to somewhere at or at least very close to the sustainable yield of the basin. And how can you do that while still staying true to the prior appropriation doctrine?
Right.
Well, as in the state engineer versus Lewis case from New Mexico, the common way it's done is the state, when they create the problem, puts up the money to solve the problem, and you can have a voluntary water rights buyout and retirement program using public funding or funding from any other source.
So a majority of the citizens can vote and say, we think the state should pay us to give up our water rights, and state engineer would approve that. Is that your idea?
The idea, well, yeah, I mean, they can't force the state, obviously, to do that, but they could say it could be a component of a plan, and another component of a plan could be cancellation of unused permits, and you start to piece together various components.
Okay, I mean, cancellation of unused permits isn't going to solve the problem, because not only is it over-appropriated on paper, it's actually being overused, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But if you begin to weed out the unused water rights, and you begin to address the problem through voluntary conservation measures. You could also potentially have mandatory irrigation efficiencies on the farm. You could have, for example, we're not disputing in the groundwater management plan the requirement that all the farmers put an upgraded meter on their system so that we're measuring water accurately. It's sort of an unstated rule in the water law that once you start measuring water, use goes down. And so you start to piece together various components of a plan that are voluntary with respect to senior rights, but you need to incentivize them to reduce water. But you cannot take water away from senior rights under the prior appropriation doctrine and give it to junior rights.
No water.
Not if you stay true to the prior appropriation doctrine. They're entitled to the full use of their water under the prior appropriation doctrine.
Unless the legislature qualifies that.
Correct.
Okay. Do you agree with Ms. Leonard that this plan achieves equipoise such that the CMA designation would be removed in 35 years?
Well, the district court agreed with the state engineer based on the factors under 534.037 subsection 2, the scientific factors. And the Baileys haven't challenged the district court's determination, but I think it is still sort of an open question whether this plan, because remember, the 34,000 acre feet that it allows to be pumped at year 35 doesn't include domestic wells and other water rights such as mining. So the pumping demand on the basin is going to be higher even than the 34,000.
Do we have a number for that?
I don't have it off the top of my head, but I think
it's in the record.
I think it may be in the record.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm at the end of my time, so the Baileys request that the court affirm the district court's decision, and thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nixon. Morning, Mr. Rickman. How are you?
Doing well, Mr. Chief Justice. Thank you very much.
Would you like the 3 minutes I allocated to your colleague?
Absolutely.
I figured you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm here today with my co-counsel, Mr. Paul Taggart, and with one of my clients, Ira and Monty Renner. Mm-hmm. Importantly, Ira was actually a member of the committee that was charged with coming up with the groundwater management plan. Unfortunately, they were not able to reach unanimity on this, and he ends up in the position that he's in today. But he put a lot of work into trying to come up with the way that we've been talking about it. And just to really quickly tag on before I get into my presentation to some of the questions that were just being asked, one of the ways that groundwater management plans could be adopted without upsetting prior appropriation, and it's not all over the West, juniors can come in and incentivize seniors to save water. So they can help the seniors put on water conservation equipment, they can help them line ditches, they can help them do this type of stuff, and then the water saved, because the juniors incentivize them to do that, goes to the seniors. That is the kind of hard work that groundwater management plans and what the legislature was expecting from groundwater management plans. But why do that hard work when you can just take the water from the seniors and not do any incentive to have them voluntarily come into the plan? And that's what happened in this case. Because the juniors vastly outnumber the seniors here, and they just voted their way into a plan to take the priority dates. And that's what's going to happen.
I mean, didn't the state engineer, I understand, so the juniors may come in and vote majority, yeah, let's take the water from the seniors, yay. But it's got to be approved by the state engineer, so it's not just a majority rule. They have to then have a state engineer who presumably is representing the public interest to say, is this a reasonable plan? And he determined it was.
And that's true. In this case, the state engineer did determine it was a reasonable plan. The state engineer was guided by the fact that it was a plan that was the majority wanted. And you see throughout his order, he talks about, well, this is what a majority of the people want. Therefore, that's what's in the public interest, and that's what I'm going to do. And unfortunately, that's just the political reality of the situation.
Can he determine that it's in the public? But let me back up. It's your position that he can't determine it's in the public interest if it would infringe on the priority.
if it would infringe on prior appropriations, this doesn't just infringe upon prior appropriations. This infringes on prior appropriations doctrine, which is a fundamental doctrine of Nevada water law. It infringes on the beneficial use doctrine, which is a vital doctrine, as Mr. Mixon pointed out. And it also, with the part that I was going to discuss, is it infringes upon what we call the non-impairment doctrine, where pre-statutory water rights are protected from any kind of impairment of their rights from any state engineer action or any application of the code. And this plan violates that non-impairment doctrine as well as the other two doctrines. So what we have here is an argument from the appellants that this one statute basically allows them to ignore all the other water laws and statutes in the state. That can't be the result. That can't be what the legislature intended without specific and clear language in the legislation. And just to address one point that Chief Justice raised with regards to, is this the right forum to bring up takings issues?
Mm-hmm.
We're arguing here about statutory interpretation. One of the primary doctrines of statutory interpretation is, where possible, if there's two readings of a statute, the one that doesn't implicate constitutional concerns is the better one. Our reading of the statute doesn't implicate constitutional concerns. The reason we're raising the takings issue is because theirs does.
Well, maybe that's the consequence. I mean, your clients may have a takings claim if we agree that the GMP was appropriate or authorized by the statute, and that's the action that was taken.
Absolutely, and that would come. That would certainly come later.
Yeah.
But for the purposes of determining what the statute means, again, where there's why not avoid that constitutional
yeah.
question altogether and go right to the interpretation that doesn't even require us to reach that?
Are you advocating? Go ahead.
In this instance, how many pre-statutory rights are we dealing with? Are we dealing with pre-1913? What's the split on the rights here? The priority dates of these rights?
Well, that's a very good question, because you heard that the plan actually does bring the basin to balance, and it absolutely does not. And this is why it does not. The numbers she referred to that are in Appendix G of the plan only cover the water rights that are covered by the plan. So the water rights covered by the plan, pumping is brought down to 34,200 acre feet at the end of 35 years, after another 35 years of groundwater decline. But that doesn't include the more than 6,500 acre feet of pre-statutory water rights where they've had to get replacement water from the aquifer because all their springs have run dry through this process. For 40 years, they've watched their springs run dry. The renters haven't even received replacement water yet. They're the northernmost spring. Their spring is still running, although it's starting to go down every year as the groundwater decline reaches them. Sadler's received replacement water because their spring ran completely dry. The Bailey's also have some replacement water because their spring ran completely dry. And so that's not even accounted for in the plan.
And that's pending in the decree litigation over this. Is that right? Or is that part of this record as well?
Yeah, there's an adjudication going on as you know, because we had that case that you recently dismissed about the replacement water rights. The numbers I'm giving you are the numbers from that adjudication. There's at least...
Were those advocated or debated in this record?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was. It absolutely was. And I know that because I'm the one who did that. I mean, I was at that public comment meeting on behalf of my clients. I brought up that issue at that public comment meeting. We brought it up at the district court, and now we're bringing it up here. So
you're saying that, like, the Big Shipley Spring is in play in this litigation as additional on top of the 34,000?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. So the non-impairment doctrine, which is what I was originally going to talk about, is one of the most fundamental doctrines of Nevada water law. It's found in NRS 533.085, and it simply states, as I said, nothing in the water law can work its way to restrict or impair the ability of pre-statutory water right holders. Here the argument is, well, they've received replacement water. We're not cutting any water use of theirs, so therefore we're not impairing it. But that ignores one simple fact, and that ignores the fact that this plan, so we've got 40 years, over four decades of water level declines. This plan continues that for another 35 years, another 3.5 decades of consistent groundwater climate, consistent overpumping of the basin, meaning that water levels continue to go down. Our clients already had to, some of our clients have already had to pay for replacement wells, pumps, electricity to bring the water out of the ground. The renters are going to be facing that situation, and there is not one thing in this plan to make them whole.
They argue that it is the northern users' use of the groundwater, that they injured themselves in effect by drilling wells too close to the springs. Now, I don't know what the state of the evidence is on that, but they contradict your point that they're to blame for that, essentially.
Well, respectfully, that they did not argue that in this proceeding.
Okay.
That was never preserved as an issue in this particular case. That was an issue in regards to the replacement water case, and they're attempting to make it an issue in regards to the adjudication. But that has actually been definitively decided by the state engineer, and they never appealed that decision. It was a ruling 6290 that the state engineer issued that said that the cause of the groundwater decline was the junior pumping in the south.
So you would say, where they refer to that in their briefs here, that that lacks record support?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
So the other thing I want to bring up is this would set a dangerous statewide precedent. Ms. Leonard actually acknowledged that this is not limited to Diamond Valley. This issue is not limited to Diamond Valley. This is a law of general applicability throughout the state. The prior appropriation doctrine is only viable, is only important when there's a shortage, when a basin is being overpumped. That's the only time it's important. If it's not being overpumped, it doesn't matter what somebody's priorities are because everybody gets their water. It's only when they're being overpumped. And so if we're going to say that in basins that are being overpumped, you can come in and get a CMA and then adopt a groundwater management plan that violates prior appropriation, then we effectively don't have prior appropriation in this state anymore, at least with respect to groundwater. If the legislature intended that result, they would have made that clear. But the district court did look at the legislative history. The district court did an investigation into the passage of AB 419. And in its order, the district court said it couldn't find one word, not one word, by any of the people who, any of the sponsors of the bill, any of the legislators, any of the people who testified on the bill, supporting an interpretation that that they meant to overturn a prior appropriation. In fact, the statements we do have on the record, we have Assemblyman Gokuchia, who was the sponsor of the bill, who specifically said it is, as I mentioned earlier, it is up to the juniors to figure out how to create the incentives to conserve water in order to make these plans work.
Are you asserting the statute's ambiguous? Because if it's not, we don't get the legislative history.
I don't believe it's ambiguous, but on the different, on the opposite reading of what Ms. Leonard is providing, I agree completely with Mr. Nixon's review of the statute. What you had is you had subsection 6 was in the law prior to AB 419. They copied that exact language from subsection 6, brought it down to subsection 7, changed the may to a shall, and added a precedent and an antecedent condition. The precedent condition was CMA for 10 years. The antecedent condition was unless a groundwater management plan is approved. All those conditions we're doing is changing where the conditions under which the may doesn't have to change to a shall. That's all it was doing. And that's why they used that copied that exact language from subsection 6, and that's why subsection 6 is so important.
Well, from the standpoint of your argument, the non-impairment argument, are you saying that if we were to interpret the groundwater management plan statute 534.110.7, the way that's advocated by appellants in this case, that interpretation would be contrary to the provisions in the water code that assure protection of prior rights?
That's absolutely correct.
So those statutes are irreconcilably in conflict.
I do agree with that, Your Honor. And where you find the evidence?
But if we were to conclude that that was the case, it does seem like the legislature can adjust the water code with respect to other senior water rights holders.
If that were the case, there's the potential that they could.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if they did, we would still then have maybe a right taking issue at that point.
Yeah, well, maybe. But the point you're making about non-impairment is those prior statutory rights can't be adjusted by subsequent statutory modifications.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. They definitely cannot. That's definitely correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence that the legislature did not want to impair pre-statutory water rights in passing this legislation is something that Goku's mm-hmm. his whole statement on his purpose for introducing this bill. He said that the purpose of the bill was to, that he said perennial yield is what we are striving for. The state engineer is not getting it done. This is actually his quote from the legislative record. State engineers are not getting it done. We continue to see these basins decline. His purpose was to bring the basin back into balance. And where do we see that in the actual text? In 534.037, you have those factors, but you also have above that the one mandatory requirement that every GMP must follow, and that is it must contain the necessary steps for removal of the critical management area designation. Since the management area designation is placed there when pumping exceeds perennial yield, logically that means that it must contain the steps to bring the basin into balance, to bring pumping below perennial yield. This plan on its face does not do that. And that harms the pre-statutory right holders because, again, they're the ones that have been bearing the brunt and taking the burden of all this over-pumping. They've had their previously free-flowing springs that were not just tremendous resources for their ranches, but tremendous ecological resources in this basin. They've had to watch for 40 years as they slowly decline and dry up and blow away.
Go ahead.
Do you and Mr. Mixon disagree on whether or not Judge Fairman correctly concluded that the GMP brings the basin into balance?
I disagree to a point. So what Judge Fairman was looking, this is the one area, so all the areas of statutory interpretation, Judge Fairman was looking at this in a de novo standpoint.
Right.
With regards to substantial evidence of whether to bring the basin back into balance, he was looking at it from the substantial evidence standard. And he was trying very hard to be deferential to the state engineer, and he was. Where I think the district court erred in that is that there's not a single piece of evidence in the record that shows that this will bring the basin into balance, and there's multiple pieces of evidence in the record from scientific sources, the USGS, current sheet engineering, different, the Herald report that you mentioned, that show that it won't bring the basin into balance. And so while the district court was being deferential to the state engineer on that factual issue, I believe that deference was misplaced.
But those references are to the reason it won't bring it into balance from your perspective is because of the pre-statutory water rights.
Because those pre-statutory water rights would be pumped. So I'll just go through the quick pieces of evidence. The USGS in 2016 did a report, and they said the basin is out of balance by 61,000 acre feet
mm-hmm.
in their report. The pumping reductions in the plan only amount to a little over 40,000 acre feet. When you look at the face of the plan, you know, this, if you add the 6,500 acre feet of the other water rights being pumped on top of the 34,200, you have over 40,000 being pumped and only 30,000 available. That's real easy math.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Herald report, which actually indicates that there might be an even lower perennial yield for the southern half of the basin. And then we were the only people who hired an expert. We hired Turner Sheet Engineering for the public comment meeting, and we had Turner Sheet Engineering look at the question. That's the only expert that has looked at the question of whether the pumping reduction will bring the basin back to balance. Looked at that specific question, and they determined that it wouldn't. And we submitted that for the record. That's properly in the record. So there's all this evidence there, and then there's no evidence on the other side, other than the state engineer's personal opinion, that it will somehow bring the basin to balance.
Counsel, if I could ask, you spoke a moment ago about legislative intent, in regard to the district court's order, they seem to rely on the unpassed legislation in SB 73 as indicative of legislative intent somehow. If we're to find that to be an error, how does that affect our analysis of the overall propriety of the district court's order?
Respectfully, I don't think that's what the district court was doing. I know that's what they've said the district court was doing. The district court took into account the failed legislation, not to determine what the legislative intent in 2011 was with regard to passing the law. They looked at the failed 2017 legislation to determine what the state engineer's prior understanding of that law was, and that it was inconsistent with his current advocacy of how the law should be interpreted. So that was the purpose of the district court looking at that 2017 legislation.
Thank you.
And so we respectfully ask that not only do you affirm the district court, but you make it clear there's four more years that they have to develop a GMP. We ask that you make it clear that the GMP has to comply with prior appropriations and has to make the seniors whole, make the precinct clear water rights users whole, and bring the basin back into balance. And thank you very much.
Your Honors, I want to address three principal things. I want to address beneficial use, I want to address vested rights, but I want to start with a really important distinction between surface water and groundwater that the district court didn't really address and the respondents don't really address. I think everyone's clear that curtailment occurs when there's a shortage. With surface water, the existence of a shortage is seasonal. Depends on precipitation and snowpack and the resulting stream flows. And so whether and when rights might be curtailed depends on where you are in the spectrum of priorities. Some years you might get nothing, some years you might get something, and some years you might get a lot more. And it just depends on the stream flows. And management of priorities for surface water is pretty easy. You open and close head gates. Groundwater is way different. For groundwater, water availability is determined by the perennial yield, which in and of itself is determined by multiple complex hydrologic and geologic factors. And a shortage means that all rights in excess of the perennial yield cannot be exercised. And so if they, based on a more or less permanent aquifer condition of what does this basin sustain? So the aquifer response to pumping or to the cessation of pumping, it's complicated. And this explains why the legislature gave the state engineer very broad authority in this legislation, because it's highly technical, it is within his expertise. He has hydrologists, geologists, hydrogeologists, and all sorts of technical people supporting him. And so this notion that the respondents raised that they have the only expert is really disingenuous, I believe, because the state engineer's office is full of experts, and it's squarely within the broad discretion of the state engineer to decide when and whether this basin is going to come into balance such that the critical management area designation can be removed. And this legislation is also clear that it's consistent with legislation that already exists in NRS 534.120, where the legislature has given the state engineer very broad authority to administer basins and make such rules, regulations, and orders as are deemed essential for the welfare of the area involved. So the state engineer gets to consider the public welfare. You don't see this in surface water, and I think it goes back to the complexity of groundwater basins and why the legislature needs to leave certain things up to to the state engineer's discretion. Let me turn to vested rights because I want to address this. First of all, it's clear vested rights are not subject to the GMP. And the district court's conclusion with regard to vested rights, that somehow because there is a time frame in which the basin will the pumping will continue to exceed the perennial yield. That the district court concluded that in and of itself violates the vested rights, pre-existing vested rights. But if that interpretation were accepted, then the statute itself, AB 419, is what would be unconstitutional, because the statute itself clearly allows for continued withdrawals in excess of the perennial yield for at least 10 years, and it doesn't set a time limit on the state engineer at all, other than that 10-year window where he has to limit withdrawals if there's no GMP. So I think that argument falls short that the respondents advance. It's also illogical that a GMP that is going to reduce pumping to the perennial yield would somehow worsen the condition of the aquifer, which is what the argument is that they're making, is saying that the GMP will make the status quo worse and therefore impairs vested rights. The district court's conclusion in this regard is not supported by any record evidence. I would note that my colleagues for the respondents were very loose on what they were referencing in terms of what is in the quote record, because they're referencing other litigation that my clients never had the opportunity in this to create a record in this case to respond to that. And so I don't believe, if you look at our opening brief on page 46, there are references regarding vested rights. And that was the best we could do, thinking that the district court was going to just stick to the administrative record, which it ended up not doing. But that is what we have in the record for the issue.
On this point, I asked Mr. Rigdon about whether the statute creating the GMP is in conflict with the water code that declares pre-statutory rights protections. What about that?
Well, I don't think there is anything in this record that ties any junior pumping in particular, any well, and shows a causal effect on any particular senior right. There is the USGS report that attributes overall pumping in the basin, which would mean senior and junior rights.
Well, did Mr. Turnipseed's report conclude, as represented here today, that the prior appropriation rights would be impaired from the GMP?
I'm sorry, are you talking about vested rights or prior appropriation?
Prior appropriation.
And so can you repeat your question, Your Honor?
Did Mr. Turnipseed's report, as represented by Mr. Rigdon, indicate that the prior appropriated rights, pre-statutory rights, would be impaired by the GMP?
Your Honor, I don't think it matters, because the substantial evidence standard doesn't take into account whether other evidence...
I'm just asking if that was his opinion.
I don't recall specifically his opinion.
So I'm assuming you don't... So your response to that argument is you don't think it matters.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it matters because substantial evidence... The standard has what the state engineer, if there's substantial evidence to support the state engineer, that is sufficient. If there's contrary evidence that the state engineer might not agree with, it doesn't make a difference with regard to the substantial evidence standard.
On a broader basis, can the legislature by statute impair prior appropriation or pre-statutory rights by a statute?
I think there are pre-existing constitutional rights that have to be protected. So I would say no, that by statute it cannot. But I think that you have to have a causal effect.
So under your plain reading of the statute that you shared with Justice Pickering earlier in the opening, when the statute talks about withdrawals, and I share your point about, or understand your point, that that's pretty wide and encompasses all withdrawals, that would not include pre-statutory rights.
No, I think it's very clear that the GMP cannot impair pre-statutory rights,
yeah.
Vested rights. We're not making the argument that it can, and we don't think there's any record evidence that shows that it does.
Okay.
The district court said, simply because pumping is going to continue beyond the perennial yield, that there's a direct causal connection with vested rights. But because you have respondents pumping wells near their springs or in their springs, even if there were curtailment of all the juniors by 100% down to zero tomorrow, where the perennial yield is only 30,000 acre feet, that's all that's going to be pumped. You don't, there's no evidence that those springs are going to come back. So there, this statute on its face does not impair vested rights, but it's certainly allow, it doesn't, you need the evidence to show that causal connection.
So I wanted to clarify something because I may have misunderstood something Mr. Rigdon said. What are the total vested rights in the basin?
The total amount? I don't remember the number.
He said 6,000, but I wasn't sure if that was just his client or the full basin.
Yeah, I don't remember the number specifically.
Okay. All right, thank you.
And just to, sorry, to be clear, and when Justice Pickering was talking to you earlier about whether the plan would result in balance after 35 years or not, and I believe the point was made by respondents that if the GMP doesn't take into account the pre-statutory rights, that in fact it wouldn't be like, does that affect your analysis and whether this meets the requirements for a GMP?
I have two responses to that. One is, that's a highly technical question. That is squarely within the discretion of the state engineer of what how the aquifer will respond to the GMP. And my other response just left my head.
I understand.
Ms. Leonard, if I could ask, I think you mentioned earlier you were going to get to this, but I wanted to comment on it. The first thing I would say is, in an era when people are so polarized in their beliefs and opinions, I think it's commendable that all the people in this basin were willing to collaboratively work towards solving their issues, but the state engineer's order still obviously has to comply with the law. How can banking water constitute beneficial use under our statutes?
Your Honor, banking water is just a matter of not withdrawing it in 1 year for use in the next year. It is not, it is and will be put to beneficial use. It's the banking of it is not the end use of it. So I think that their argument with regard to that is a little misleading, because I think that the notion and the idea is that we want to make water most efficiently used. This is a shortcoming of the prior appropriation doctrine. It also requires use it or lose it, which is a problem in terms of conserving water. And so the GMP tries to address that element of prior appropriation by saying, don't use it just because you have to. You save it for when you need it.
But doesn't that, again, going back to beneficial use, under the GMP that's been proposed, you've got those holders that haven't been putting their water to beneficial use that are going to get shares in this plan, and they can bank, they can sell, but yet they haven't made beneficial use of the water. How does that comport with what you just said?
So I think that this notion that these water rights have never been put to beneficial use is a false premise.
But then there was an indication by the state engineer, I believe, that it would be a notice issue and a delay issue to notify these people that haven't been putting their rights to use. And it would encourage those folks to come forth and say, I better start pumping, which affects the basin as well.
Well, and that goes back to the broad discretion given to the state engineer, who made the logical conclusion that if he starts initiating forfeiture and abandonment proceedings now, that it will have the perverse result of increasing pumping in an already compromised basin. And as you pointed out, that it could have it could take years to solve the administrative and legal proceedings, but the statute doesn't afford. So there are other things I can say with regard to beneficial use, but my time is up. I appreciate the court's time, and I again want the court to go back to the purpose of the statute. It would be given no effect if a GMP must strictly conform to priorities. So,
thank you. Do my colleagues have any additional questions for counsel? All right, seeing none, the court would like to extend its thanks and appreciation to Ms. Leonard and her colleagues, Mr. Mixon, Mr. Rigdon, Mr. Taggart. I'm sure you were writing notes. Thank you all for your excellent arguments today and your exceptional briefing in the case. The matter will stand.